was the chairman of the board. No, not Frank Sinatra, but John Parmenter Robarts, Prime Minister of Ontario from 1961 to 1971. They didn't call them premiers back then. His is a fascinating story of how hard work made for a successful career in public life and how hard living made for a less than successful private life. Amongst law reform in Ontario, Go Transit, a new community college system, the Ontario Science Centre, and more, were failed marriages, a son's suicide, illness and stroke, and his own suicide in 1982. This remarkable life is the subject of a new book, Public Triumph, Private Tragedy, The Double Life of John P. Robarts, $35 Canadian, published by Viking. The author Steve Paikin joins me on the line this morning. Steve Paikin is the best-selling author of The Life and the Dark Side, one of my favorite books ever, and he's covered politics for over 20 years. He's toiled in print and at the CBC, where I remember watching him on midday whenever I'd come home from school for lunch. He's been with TV Ontario since 1982, co-hosting the flagship Current Affairs program Studio 2 and their foreign affairs series Diplomatic Immunity, which incidentally has its season finale this Friday, the 3rd of June, with two special guests, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski. It took me a while to practice that. Please welcome to the commentary.ca Steve Paikin. Good morning, Mr. Paikin.
Joseph, good to be with you today, and I shudder to think how much older I am than you, given that you were watching me after coming home from school. Ouch.
Doesn't that make you feel old?
Yes, it does. Thanks very much.
You have the reputation of being pretty young and covering politics, and I hate to ruin your morning. A couple of political things before we get to the book. Stephen Harper in your province, and I'm interested to get your perspective since you cover Ontario well, and for so long and know the nuance of the electorate and politics there. How is he doing in Ontario? Is he resonating with the public there, and how do you think he will do in the next federal election, whenever that'll be?
Well, let's start with how he's doing right now. Every single public opinion poll for the last 10 years, I think, with the exception of one, has shown the Progressive Conservative Party, Canadian Alliance, Conservative Party of Canada, whichever incarnation you prefer, doing a bad second to the Liberals. There was one poll which showed them in first place, and that only lasted for about 1 week, so, you know, maybe it's a rogue poll, maybe it was a short-lived victory, who knows. I think the problem right now with the conservative movement, if I can call it that, in Ontario, is that it does not seem to be connecting with the vast majority of Ontarians, either at the federal or the provincial level. And as I look at the seat map right now, all of the cities the Conservative Party, be it federally or provincially, has yet to penetrate. If you think about all the major cities in this province, Toronto, Ottawa, Hamilton, London, North Bay, Kitchener, Sudbury, Sault Ste. Marie, Timmins, Thunder Bay, Windsor, the list goes on and on, the Conservatives have no seats, federally or provincially. It's really quite astonishing. And the Liberals, whatever their troubles federally, seem to still have a basic connection with the voting public here. Not a massive one, and nothing they can certainly take for granted, but certainly enough of a connection that so far, regardless of what Stephen Harper has tried, he's not been able to push himself into a position of significance with the voters here yet. I don't like making any predictions about the future because, as we know, a week is a lifetime in politics, and there will be many lifetimes before the next federal election takes place. But I think we can say, looking at the polls today and the electoral map today, that Mr. Harper has one hell of a job ahead of him, and despite his best efforts so far, he has yet to make that connection with the largest plurality in the people of Ontario.
In Vancouver, the Conservatives have no seats. So do you think that that's a phenomenon that in urban centers the Conservative Party just doesn't do well?
No, I wouldn't say that, because obviously they have in the past. You know, in the 1980s, Brian Mulroney won back-to-back majority governments, getting enormous amounts of seats in cities. And Mike Harris, who ran by most accounts, a pretty right-wing government in Ontario, also won lots of seats in lots of cities in this province. So it's nothing that hasn't happened before, and it's nothing that, you know, we could say will never happen again. But we certainly can say that for a whole variety of reasons, the Liberals seem to have the right mix in the cities of this province right now, and the Conservatives do not.
Yeah, let's talk about John Roberts. You mentioned that he actually in the greater Toronto area used to win seats, and the Conservatives don't have any seats now. Is that true?
Oh, that's right. The Ontario Conservative Party today has zero seats in the city of Toronto. John Robarts, back in the day, used to win seats in downtown Toronto, in inner-city Toronto. His Minister of Mines was from a seat in downtown Toronto. His Attorney General was from a seat in downtown Toronto. They had a pretty good formula back then, Joseph. I got to tell you that, you know, the Ontario Conservative Party ruled this province for 42 straight years. It was an electoral record unrivaled anywhere in the world that I'm aware of. And Robarts was the premier of this province, or prime minister as he was then technically called, during the 10 best years this province ever had. And he managed to put together, it's all about finding the right balance, and he managed to find the right balance in the middle of the political spectrum whereby he could appeal to right-wingers, to left-wingers, to people in the middle. And in the 1963 Ontario election, he won the largest percentage of the total vote in post-war Ontario history, 48.9%. No one never done it before or since. So the mix that he brought to the job was clearly right for the time.
What do you think that was that made him so popular and successful in those 10 years that he was premier? Was that his own personal charisma, which he had in abundance, or was it just the times you mentioned that they were the most successful years in Ontario's history that they wanted someone like Robarts as premier?
Well, it was all of those things and more. Certainly, he had the good fortune to be the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party in Ontario halfway through a terrific dynasty. So, right party, right time, that helped. The Conservative Party had always been brilliant in the way it managed generational change. In other words, the guy they picked to replace the old guy was always representative of the next generation, so the party had a way of renewing itself that people found comfortable and effective. When the party got away from that, twice actually in the last few decades, was when they picked Ernie Eves more recently, and he went on to lose the next election, and then Frank Miller back in 1985, who was the same age as the outgoing Premier Bill Davis, and they ended up losing power after that election as well. But at this time, we're talking 1961 now, the Conservative Party just was, seen as very competent, very managerial, basically reflecting the general values of the public, getting out somewhat progressive on certain social issues, very conservative in economic issues. The budgets were always balanced, the revenues were always flying in, and they were builders in those days, Joe. Let me tell you, we got a whole community college system in the 1960s because of decisions made by John Robarts and his education minister, Bill Davis, who, as you know, would go on to become premier after him. We got GO Transit, which was a tremendous commuter system that's still in place today. We got the Ontario Science Center, which millions of children have visited and learned about science from. We got Ontario Place, which was and still is a very popular recreation spot on the waterfront in Toronto. Again, a decision made by John Robarts to build that. We got civil rights legislation because Robarts was concerned about what was going on in various police investigations, called a Royal Commission. Numerous recommendations that were passed into law guaranteeing civil rights for people. The list goes on. He really was. He was a right man for his time, that's for sure.
And you compare him to John Kennedy, don't you?
I think I certainly didn't make the comparison at the beginning of my research into Robarts because I just wouldn't have known it. But by the end, it's quite amazing how many comparisons there are, how many similarities. They both win their elections in 1961. They're both about the same age. I think, within a year of each other. Both World War II heroes. Robarts served as well, was shelled off the coast of Italy, came home a war hero. They both ran progressive governments, conservative economically. They both, in terms of their social life, had, how do you want to put this? I mean, the rumors were all out there, and they enjoyed the company of women, not necessarily their wives. They could walk into the room. They were the best-looking guy in the room. They could suck all the oxygen out of a room. They were loved by men. They were loved by women. And they both exited the world in the same tragic way. Kennedy's was by an assassin's bullet, and Robarts, by his own hand, shot himself in the head.
There were a number of I call them Robarts loyalists, these former cabinet ministers, mm-hmm. aides and the sort, and they prodded you to write this book, didn't they?
Yeah, it's interesting. They still, John Robarts had been dead for 23 years almost, and yet every year around Christmas time, dozens of his colleagues get together at an old club in downtown Toronto, and they have an annual John P. Robarts Robarts luncheon. And they continue to do it to this day. And I did a documentary on Robarts for TV Ontario, and I guess a few of them had seen it, and so they invited me to this lunch, ostensibly to put the full court press on me to write a biography on Robarts. And I was in the midst of writing what I'm delighted to hear is one of your favorite books, The Dark Side, at the time, and I said to them, you know, I'm in the middle of writing this second book. I haven't even, you know, a third book. Forget it. I have no desire or intention to write a third book or time. I want my life back. You know, I've been working on these two books to the exclusion of too much else. And they said, and I said, besides that, there's already been a book written about the Robarts years. And Darcy McHugh, who was future treasurer of the province of Ontario, one of Robarts' cabinet ministers, said to me, the book that was written about Robarts was dry. It was academic, it was scholarly, but it was dry. And he said, if there's one thing John Robarts was not, he was not dry in either sense of the word. And we need a good book on Robarts, not just on his government, but on the kind of guy he was. And the more and more I listened to them, the more I came to agree with them. I thought the guys, the mix of the guys' public triumph and private tragedy just made for a very, very compelling story. And so they convinced me.
David, but don't you think that encouragement, if you will, from people like Darcy McHugh, that colored your assessment of him?
Well, if you read the book, I don't know how you can come to that conclusion, because
it is pretty fair, I must say, but I do wonder that perhaps, you know, people will ask that question, that it is probably because it came from them.
The impetus to get the book written was certainly theirs. I was quite happy just having done the documentary for TVO and had no plans to take it further. The impetus to write the book certainly came from them after that. But as I made it abundantly clear to everybody who was involved with this, and I interviewed probably 100 of his friends and relatives, family members, former government associates, and so on, and as I said to his lone surviving family member, Robin, his daughter, at the book launch, this is not an authorized biography. And I said to Robin, you know, there will be things that you will read in this book that you will not like. But I'm trying to tell a, I hope, fair and balanced and thorough account of a great Canadian's life, but a flawed Canadian's life. And as a result, yes, the public triumphs are in there, but as well, you know, I do talk about the fact that, you know, his first wife made, I guess, the worst decision she could have made by refusing to move the family to Toronto after he became premier. And as a result, they became estranged over his 20-year career in public life. Alcohol was too big a feature in her life. Certainly, she was an alcoholic, and it was probably too big a factor in his life, although no one ever saw him drunk. His son killed himself. He killed himself. He certainly had a flawed personality, and he was a lonely man. He spent a lot of time in Toronto by himself, going to bars, you know, at 1 o'clock in the morning or something like that, just looking for friendship and accompaniment, because, you know, he did live apart from his family basically 5 or 6 days a week for almost 20 years. So all of that's in there as well. So I'm not too – I understand why people would raise the issue of whether or not this book is too sweet to Robarts, if you want to put it that way. But I think after you read it, you would not come away with that impression.
Page 266 of the book, you write, I write this book in large part because I don't want others of my generation to be as ignorant of this great Canadian as I am. What's the reaction been for this book, for the documentary that came before it, from people your age, for people my age, that probably were too young or never knew John Robarts?
For sure. Well, I was a year old when he became Prime Minister of Ontario, so I certainly never met him. I never even saw him. I have no first-hand recollections of John Robarts at all. And I think one of the greatest satisfactions I have from having done the documentary and now the book is the feedback. Joseph, I've never had more feedback on anything I've ever done in my professional life. Nothing. I mean, the people who are of our parents' generation wrote me, emailed me, called me to say thank you for this, you know, wonderfully nostalgic look back at a better time in our public life, and you know, good for you for telling the story. But I did have a lot of young people call me as well. Darcy McHugh's son sent me an email the other day saying, you know what, I was a little kid when all this happened. You filled in so many blanks for me about my dad's own life, let alone for Mr. Robarts' life. Mr. Robarts was his godfather. So this has been very rewarding to me, that young people who I shared history, and who don't, you know, in many respects, they're no fault of their own. You can blame the school system. You can blame the fact that we don't read enough. Blame whatever you like. But I'm trying to make some modest contribution to getting a what I hope is a very readable book out there on the history of a guy who was just a major, major figure in our history, but who I don't think we know enough about.
We're talking with the author Steve Paikin, also of TVO. His latest book is the eminently readable and fascinating Public Triumph and Private Tragedy, The Double Life of John P. Robarts, published by Viking, $35 Canadian. Let's talk about the significance of Robarts as a Canadian politician, as a national figure, if you will. Mm-hmm. The Confederation of Tomorrow Conference was an excellent exercise in nation building on his part, was it not?
We have to put this in the context of the times. The answer to your question is yes, and here's why. Nowadays, you know, first ministers get together all the time. It's not seen as any big deal. Back then, we're talking our centennial year, 1967. It didn't happen. And the notion that people would all get together to talk about the state of the country, first ministers, this is something the country hadn't done before. And here's Robarts, a guy who doesn't speak a word of French, from London, Ontario, which is, not the most exciting city in the world today, no offense, and it sure wasn't 40 years ago. Here's a guy who's got curiosity about what's going on in Quebec. These rumblings about a more assertive Quebec nationalism and nationhood. What is this all about? And so he invites all the premiers to the top story of the Toronto Dominion Centre in 1967 in the fall, and he says, let's just have a dialogue. Let's just talk about this. And they put it on TV. And I'm telling you, back then, this is, remember, well before News World, 24-hour news coverage, people never saw politicians, particularly Quebec politicians, speaking English and French on their television sets, trying to gain a greater understanding of the country back then. And the fact that this guy, who really, would have no reason to have any deep understanding of Quebec society, the fact that he was the catalyst that got it all started, I think speaks volumes for his patriotism and for his wisdom in wanting to understand what makes the country tick and how to keep it together. National unity was always number one on his radar screen.
And then there was, of course, much later, the Pépin Robarts Commission, right?
That's right. This was Pierre Trudeau appointed him and Jean-Luc Pépin from Quebec to co-chair a national unity task force to essentially take the temperature of the country. This was after René Lévesque and the PQ won that election in 1976. And, they were a great team, totally opposite. Here's Jean-Luc Pépin, who is sort of fiery Quebecer, very emotional, and Robarts, by this point, out of public life, a lawyer, lots of boards of directors, sort of a captain of industry, a much better listener than Pépin would have been, and very representative of sort of fat cat English Canada. And yet the two of them made a dynamic duo, and this was a great national undertaking. They traveled all over the country and listened to people, essentially to the public's. It was a taking of the temperature of the country, and if you read it today, it stands up very well as an important document in the history of the country.
He was also opposed to Medicare when Pearson and Trudeau wanted to implement that. You call it his prescience, in that he saw that it would be unsustainable.
Well, the one question I get asked a lot is, how can you like Robarts so much when he was against the most cherished social program in the history of the country? And the answer is because I think he saw more beneath the surface of this than we give him credit for. And that is, yes, Medicare, we all love Medicare today. It's considered one of the founding principles of the country in some respects. But go back to the time. In the late 1960s, Ontario had its own, apparently quite excellent, publicly funded Medicare program. Now, admittedly, it wasn't a national program. It only took care of Ontarians. But it was there, and it was good. Robarts was afraid that if he gave that up and went into a scheme with the federal government whereby today, meaning 1967, 68, they're paying 50 cent dollars to help fund the program, but who knows what in the future, that worried him. And I use the word prescience because he had every right to be worried. Look where the federal government is now on health care. Back then, they're paying 50 cents on the dollar to help support a program they initiated. Today, they're paying whatever it is, 13, 14 cents on the dollar. And Robarts called it a Machiavellian scheme. He was really worried that the feds would try to gain so much glory coming in and creating this program, but then not adequately funding it at the end of the day, and the provinces would be held with the bill. And you ask every provincial treasurer in the country, and they'll tell you that's exactly what's come true.
There's a fascinating story in the book about his I don't know, he didn't have a national aspiration to lead a political party, did he? Or, and there's a story you tell about how he was to succeed Robert Stanfield, but that never came through because he never picked up his phone.
Yeah, you know what? It's one of those really strange moments in our history. But if you think back, in 1972, there was a federal election in which the Liberals under Pierre Trudeau, who had gone from Trudeau mania to really unpopular in just 4 years, he managed to beat Robert Stanfield, the leader of the Conservatives, in that 72 election by 2 seats. And there were a lot of rumblings in the months leading up to that election, whereby Stanfield, who feared he didn't have what it took to beat Trudeau, offered to step down and see to it that Robarts was his successor. And Robarts had never really entertained the option in the past, but apparently was open to discussing it, but would not initiate it because he didn't want to, he was a very loyal conservative and he did not want to look like he was stabbing his leader in the back. And so he refused to initiate any communication with Mr. Stanfield to discuss this, which meant that it all had to come from Stanfield's side, and they had tried to initiate some contact with Robarts to make it happen, and it just never did. They just couldn't get, you know, this is in the days before BlackBerries and cell phones, and they just could never get their wires straight, and they never ended up discussing it. Make a long story short, Stanfield ends up going into the election and comes within 2 seats, and I, you know, speculate today that if Robarts had led that party, the Conservative Party at this time, when he's certainly a much more popular figure in Ontario than Stanfield would have been, is it conceivable that Robarts could have found in the province of Ontario 2 or 3 more seats than Stanfield did? I think probably yes, in which case our whole nation's history would have been different. Robarts would have become prime minister, and the next 20 years would have been very different.
It's another delicious game of what if, right?
Indeed.
A couple of other things. The photo on the front cover, it looks like a stage shot that you got an actor to do it, but that's actually Robarts.
Oh, no, that's him. That is absolutely him. And the reason I love that photo so much is that I think it encapsulates just the contrast and the sort of mysteriousness of his life. It's a shot of, you know, Robarts essentially looking very statesmanlike and very chairman of the boardish, but looking down, and you can't really see his eyes, and there's a mystery about them. And as a result, you know, you see this strong public figure, if you like, but I think also, given the nature of the pose, it hints at a more mysterious and private, you know, underside to his life, which is essentially what the whole story is about.
What's the context that photo's taken from?
You know, a Toronto Star photographer just snapped that somewhere late in his career. I don't know where they shot it, but it, you know, when I saw it, I thought, boy, that's a good one. Let's go with that.
And then the photo on the back, his arms are around the waist of a beautiful Toronto Argonaut cheerleader.
Yeah, well, this is the other side of his life. You know, you've got the sort of statesman-like yet mysterious man on the cover, and on the back page, back cover, he is doing, I don't know, some kind of, you know, line dance or something with Miss Grey Cup or Miss Toronto Argonaut or something like that, and you know, he's obviously twice or three times her age at that point, and it's nothing that any premier could be photographed doing today because it's just way too out there, and yet there he was, you know, old fat cat Tory, old man Ontario, not old man Ontario, but sort of representing, you know, Bay Street in Ontario, and looking pleased as punch to be doing some kind of shimmying with a much, much younger woman.
A couple of questions you'll indulge me. Having read the book, and I guess it's your writing style that makes me ask these questions, and it's fascinating things that I've been thinking about since I finished the book. His son, Tim, committed suicide. There was a 12-page suicide letter that he left. Did you ever get to read that in the course of your writing this book?
No, I never did. And, in fact, I don't know if the letter survives to this day. I did ask Robin, John's daughter, Tim's sister, where the letter is today, and she didn't know. And she did read it, though. And she is the one who told me that that the letter was not, you know, it was not an angry letter. It was not an accusatory letter. It was a letter which simply said, you know, I was meant to be on this earth for 21 years, and that's it. Tim was a troubled kid. He had health problems from the get-go. He got into drugs. His father's absences were very difficult on him. He ended up living alone in London with an increasingly alcoholic mother and really just was all very sad by the end, and he just decided to end it all. And his father at the time thought it was a terrible decision, and it certainly took the wind out of John's sails. But later on, as John had his own health issues and personal problems, I think he came to realize that Tim's solution to his own dilemma was a courageous one for him, and I know that John changed his mind about his son's suicide at the end. I think he came to understand why he did it.
And the other thing, you asked his second wife, Catherine, about the charge that she had shoved him. What was her reaction when you asked that question?
Well, she denied it, of course. Just to put this in some context, Catherine is his second wife, 28 years his junior, a beautiful woman. They got on famously at the beginning. They used to hunt and sail and fish and go to political receptions together and really enjoyed life a lot. She did all the things with John Robarts that his first wife refused to do, and which was one of the many reasons for their estrangement. But after John had a series of strokes in 1981, their marriage really went sour. She didn't want to be a nursemaid to an older, infirm man, and he would have, you know, pretty terrible mood swings as a result of the depression he was suffering because he couldn't do anything anymore. All those things he loved to do, he couldn't do anymore. Robarts told a friend of his who told me that, she shoved him, this is all in the realm of he said, she said at this point, but certainly their marriage got pretty terrible near the end, and it may well be that he saw suicide as a solution to both his failing health and to his failing marriage.
We could talk for hours, but I just realized looking at the clock that I've kept you longer than I promised. So the last question will be, what's the next book? Are you working on something now?
I am not. and having written 3 books in 4 years while hosting 2 television programs and trying to be a good father to 4 children, I'm not going to write any books for a little while. I want my life back, Joseph.
Well, Steve, thanks so much for joining us today, and again, continued good luck with this book. It's a fascinating one and an interesting one. Even if you have no interest, as I did, with Ontario politics, it's worth picking up because it is a good story. Not a good story, but a good story in that it is a tragedy, and we all seem to like tragedies for some reason.
Well, it does tell a story about a particular time in the life of our country, and I certainly don't think you have to be a citizen of Ontario to be attracted to this guy's story and to find meaning in it. And let me just also thank you for taking the trouble to read the book, which obviously made all your questions so much better than they otherwise would have been, so I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us, Steve. The book is called Public Triumph, Private Tragedy, The Double Life of John P. Robarts, $35 Canadian, published by Viking. If you get TVO on your television, wherever you are in this country, do watch Studio 2 and Diplomatic Immunity, especially this Friday. Steve Paikin here on thecommentary.ca. I'm Joseph Plenum.